From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The White House unveils a plan to take over Washington, D.C.
All of the functions of the district government were given to the district government by the federal government. The district government was essentially an agency of the federal government when Home Rule began. So that the fact that we are taking back problems that we handed to them isn't that the local government somehow is foisting them upon us. We are simply reshuffling the deck in a way that we think is more fair.
We'll look at a late-night deal in Israel over the future of Hebron. And today would have been Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 68th birthday. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! To Democracy Now!, I am Amy Goodman. FBI Director Louis Freeh said yesterday he had ordered an immediate investigation into the taping and leaking of a telephone conference call between House Speaker Newt Gingrich and his top lieutenants. Freeh's announcement came as the House Ethics Committee's top Democrat, Congressmember Jim McDermott of Washington, who was at the center of the tape furor, announced conditionally he would step aside from consideration of the Gingrich ethics case. Freeh said the investigation would look into a possible illegal telephone interception and the subsequent dissemination of the contents of the telephone call. Yesterday, New York Congressmember Republican Bill Paxon held a news conference.
Our nation's laws have been broken. They've been broken by a number of people. These are laws that were written by this Congress, in which some of these members, in which the members today serve. We all have a responsibility to uphold those laws.
Mr. Paxon, in the context of current House ethics charges, would it be sufficient for the Republican leadership if whatever Democratic congressmen are involved said they were sorry and had bad legal advice?
These are felony crimes under both federal and state codes. There are a number of states involved here where calls originated, parts of this conference call originated from various states where this was disseminated to the media. This is a serious federal and state felony matter for the appropriate criminal justice agencies. We wrote those laws for an important reason. 40 million Americans today rely on essentially the sanctity of the cellular phone to conduct their business or personal affairs. Now, I think we all know that people can listen in on them. The difference is, well, we know that, we don't suspect that people, our business competitors, folks that we may not get along with personally, are gonna use those to our detriment or to their advantage for partisan or business purposes or otherwise. That was done in this case, and it's just wrong.
The New York Times is reporting today a former Archer Daniels Midland Company executive who spied for the government in a price-fixing case admitted faking documents to support his claims of FBI wrongdoing. The report is the latest twist in a case that led to millions of dollars in fines against ADM and other companies and criminal charges against several executives, including Mark Whitaker. Whitaker taped conversations that are widely believed, along with plea agreements with foreign companies and executives, to have forced ADM to pay a record $100 million in fines in October. The agribusiness was fined for fixing prices for citric acid and lysine, which speeds muscle growth in livestock. Marijuana is legal for some in California. The first legal sales of marijuana since the 1930s begin today at the Cannabis Cultivators Club in San Francisco. Club founder Dennis Perrone says he has more than 200 doctor's prescriptions for pot to ease nausea and pain associated with AIDS and cancer. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and PLO Chair Yasser Arafat have agreed upon a deal which commits Israel to hand over most of the West Bank town of Hebron to Palestinian self-rule within 10 days and largely rural parts of the territory by mid-1998. We'll have more on that story later in the show. Bulgaria's ruling socialists, buffeted by 9 days of street protests, appeared today to soften their stand on opposition calls for a general election and suggested an early poll before the end of this year. The party's opponents have organized the protests on the back of public anger over deepening economic hardship, and workers held a series of one-hour warning strikes around the country today. President Nelson Mandela of South Africa has rejected a warning from the United States over a proposed arms deal with Syria and said that South Africa would conclude deals with whichever country it chooses. The United States said on Monday it's extremely concerned by news of South Africa's proposed sale to Syria of aim-enhancing gear worth $641 million for its Soviet-made tanks and threatened to cut off aid if the deal went ahead. Taiwan today took delivery of four launching vehicles for U.S.-made Patriot missiles, part of a drive to improve its defenses in the face of rival China's army modernization, this according to the United Evening News. And this news from Wellington, New Zealand. Greenpeace activists protested outside the Japanese consulate in Auckland today, and New Zealand expressed regret at news that a ship carrying plutonium waste to Japan would pass through the Southwest Pacific. About 20 Greenpeace protesters demonstrated outside the consulate while others unfurled a banner reading, "New Zealanders say no to plutonium on the building." And you're listening to Democracy Now! The Clinton administration unveiled yesterday a new plan to oversee the District of Columbia. The deal calls for federal managers to take over key local government functions, including tax collection and the prisons. Many local officials welcome the move, which will relieve the city of some major costs like pensions and Medicaid. Still, the Clinton plan avoids tackling some of the urgent issues facing the 500,000 people of the District of Columbia, most notably the question of democracy in the federal enclave. Yesterday at a news conference, U.S. Budget Director Franklin Delano Raines explained the move.
All of us in the nation have an interest in the well-being of the nation's capital. We all have an interest in ensuring that the nation's capital works and it's a city that we can all be proud of. And that's a national interest. The second I would mention to you is that all of the functions of the district government were given to the district government by the federal government. The district government was essentially an agency of the federal government when home rule began. So that the fact that we are taking back problems that we handed to them isn't that the local government somehow is foisting them upon us. We are simply reshuffling the deck in a way that we think is more fair.
Carol O'Clarkin is joining us now, as well as Sam Jordan, to discuss the implications of the president's plan, but also to talk about her own proposal. Carol O'Clarkin is a visiting fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based Brookings Institution, formerly the chief economist for New York's largest union, District Council 37 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, known as AFSCME. We're also joined by Sam Jordan, chair of the D.C. Statehood Party, and a research fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, just around the same time that they were making these proposals on Capitol Hill, you were holding a news conference, Carol O'Clarkin, to talk about your report, The Orphaned Capital, Adopting a Revenue Plan for the District of Columbia. Can you tell us what you're proposing and how it differs from President Clinton's plan to take over D.C.?
Well, I think we were both starting in the same direction, and that is recognizing that the nation's capital is a unique constitutional entity. It's unlike any other city. Its economy functions like a city, but it also has to provide state services, and it does not have in its revenue, its ability to tax, the reach that a normal state would have. So I'd sort of start by making a correction in your lead into this, where you said the federal government would be taking back or taking over local services. They're not. They're taking state-type services. And one of the problems...
Which are like?
Prisons are a state-type service. Medicaid is provided by states all around the country. Cities don't provide Medicaid. Welfare, parts of welfare are state-type services. Mental health is usually a state-type service. Higher education, always a state-type service. Now, they're not doing all of that. In the president's proposal, they're not doing all of that. But they are proposing to rationalize a bit what the district does compared to what the federal government provides, recognizing that to make this place more like a city, you have to have change what it does to look more like a city and have some agent step in and play the role of the state. And that's where the title of my study starts, The Orphaned Capital. This is the only city in America without a state. There's no state to give it state aid. There's no state to share a wider tax burden with it, and there's no state to provide all the services that states provide to places like Boston and Memphis and San Francisco and you name it. Okay, but I think that the president's plan only goes part of that way. It doesn't really. It doesn't do the revenue part at all. That is what the Brookings. That's what my plan does.
How do you come up with the revenue part?
What I did was look at what not having a state and being the nation's capital. Those unique qualities of the District of Columbia mean for its revenue structure, and it really means that the tax base is severely restricted, that there is no state aid, that the hometown industry is tax exempt, so there's a whole lot of taxable base that other cities have that the district doesn't have, and that the Department of Finance and Revenue is broken. Once I made that analysis, I looked for remedies which would make the district be more like a typical American city and have the federal government play the role of a state. So on the district side, I would be eliminating four business taxes that are basically state-type taxes that raise the cost of doing business in the district prohibitively compared to the places that surround the district. So I have one place that this is that the Brookings plan is very different from the president's plan is that we would cut district taxes in order to keep economic activity here. There is nothing in the president's plan to help stem the flow of people and businesses from the district and make the district more competitive.
Don't you also continue the payment fee that goes to Washington, D.C.?
That's the other side. I have kind of two structural proposals here. One is what the district has to do with its own tax structure, and the second is what has to be the fiscal relationship between the district and the federal government.
Because people should understand, since we're talking to people all over the country right now, how much does the Congress give each year to Washington, D.C.?
They give $660 million, which amounts to less than $2.50 a year per every American. And that is for the nation's capital. And I'm not born and raised in the district. I just come in to do this project. So as an outsider to the district, I was kind of floored when I began to look at, I did not know, and I suspect there are many of your listeners who do not know, that the District of Columbia is established in the Constitution of the United States. There is no other city in America that's established in the Constitution. What is established in the Constitution is the federal government and states. The states give their power to the federal government. But the District of Columbia was established in Article 1. It was called a district, and governance of that district was given to the Congress. And it seems to me that that is one of the few responsibilities that the founders of this nation gave to the federal government. So I think our vocabulary is a little bit off on this issue. I think when people talk about this as a takeover, that's a wrong kind of word. I think that when people talk about this as a bailout, right, it's a loaded vocabulary. That's the wrong kind of vocabulary. As an American, this is my capital city. There is only one capital city here.
Sam Jordan, what are your thoughts both on the president's plan and on Carol Clarkin's?
Well, let me first mention, Amy, that we have seen a proliferation of plans over the years. This is not the first time of a number of plans have been offered for the city's politics. I think, though, that Carol Clarkin's plan, the Brookings Institute plan, the orphaned city, and the president's plan actually miss the point and don't achieve a definitive solution for the district's problems. And I think that there is this giddiness about the proliferation of plans and no real attempt to get to the core problem facing the district. The core problem facing the district is not that these are state-type functions. The core problem of the district is the issue of sovereignty, that this is not a state. In fact, none of these plans address in any definitive way a political or jurisdictional or legal solution. In other words, with the plans and the plans adopted by the or proposed by Brookings and proposed by the president, neither of them addresses the question of sovereignty. So in other words, we're left with a plan that's really subject to the whim of Congress again. In other words, we can have this plan installed, and the next Congress, 106th Congress, can say we don't like it at all and we don't have a plan any longer. So what we should do, and what the Statehood Party always recommends, and we have to teach this to the country at large, is let's look at the fundamental relationship that obtains now between the district and Congress. First of all, we are unique in a number of ways. We are unique in the fact that we are the only jurisdiction in the nation that doesn't tax all income at its source. Neither of these plans actually addresses that in a definitive way. We are the only jurisdiction that does not tax all income earned at the source. As a result,
I don't know what you mean by
that.
Well,
then let me finish.
Because there are some,
excuse me,
there are some states that don't have income taxes.
I don't recall interrupting you. Let me sort of finish. You took a few minutes to explain your position. I want to take a few minutes to explain mine. Let me say this. We have, in the District of Columbia, $35 billion earned in private individual wages and salaries each year. $23 billion of that is earned by non-residents. We don't tax one penny of that. That's what's unique about the district. We're the only jurisdiction in the nation that doesn't do that. Every other jurisdiction has some form of taxation of income earned at a source. These are normally called reciprocal taxation arrangements. Most familiar one, I think, to most people around the nation might be New Jersey and New York City. And this differs from a commuter tax. Commuter tax is you pay a tax going through the Holland Tunnel no matter where you live. A reciprocal tax, those persons who live in New Jersey but work in New York pay a tax rate on their New York earnings, and it is credited to their home state tax liability. That's a reciprocal tax. Neither of these plans addresses that. Another, the federal government should make a fair federal and predictable formula federal payment to the district. How do we arrive at this? We have to look at what is the federal burden on the city, and that's not addressed exactly in these plans. The federal burden, as costed out by the GAO, by the OMB, comes to about $2 billion per year. $2 billion per year. That amounts to the land in the district that's taken off our tax rolls, tax exemptions for the military and diplomatic sector, and services rendered directly by the city to the federal enclave. $2 billion. That's $660 million Mr. Clarke-Kane mentioned earlier. That is all the federal government gives us in lieu of taxes. $660 million is only a third of what they of the federal burden on the city. So we have to talk about a fair federal payment, not simply a substitute for the federal payment. Now, that's what we would suggest, even if we were to negotiate one-half the amount of the federal burden. That's $1 billion. Now, if we look at that reciprocal taxation on incomes earned in the city but not by non-residents, not taxed by the district, if even a 3% tax there would be $630 million, 2% about $440 million. Now, we have an addition on the eve of home rule, a number of organizations influencing Congress, lobbying Congress heavily, achieved tax-exempt status for their operations. Now, we have among these super tax-exempt, sometimes profit, nonprofit organizations, Fannie Mae, Sallie Mae, National Geographic. Fannie Mae alone would owe the district almost $330 million on its income were it to be taxed fairly at D.C. rates. Now, it isn't coincidental that Franklin D. Raines, who made the announcement, is a former Fannie Mae vice president, protecting Fannie Mae in Congress from a movement there to tax Fannie Mae fairly.
And explain exactly what Fannie Mae is.
Fannie Mae is the Federal National Mortgage Association, and it is one of the chief home mortgage providers around the nation. And they generate $6 billion in revenues each year, $4 billion of which goes to mortgages. $2 billion is distributed among their taxpayers and officers. So they're very well paid. Now, here's my point here. We have some economic justice issues that are not addressed by either of these plans, but they're tied together by the issue of sovereignty. Without there being statehood, we have this constant possibility of the next Congress deciding on its whim to disown any plan reached by an earlier Congress or president.
Carola Clarican.
I'm sorry. I cannot let a misdescription of my plan go forward without saying something. The plan I've put forward at Brookings has exactly a formula-based federal payment to the District of Columbia, and it has it as a payment in lieu of taxes, and we have costed that amount. It has it as a state aid, which would simply be parity for the District of Columbia vis-a-vis its higher level of government, the same way Boston gets state aid from Massachusetts and Memphis gets from Tennessee and Chicago gets from Illinois and New York City gets from New York State. And it would also have compensation for the state-type services that the district is forced to provide. And in the president's proposal, the federal government would be providing some of those services, but not all of them. So there would still be a role to compensate for the kinds of services that the district has to do.
We're talking to Carol O'Clarican, who is a visiting fellow at the Washington-based Brookings Institution, and we're talking to Sam Jordan, chair of the D.C. Statehood Party. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now, the exception to the rulers. In just a minute, we're going to be talking about Martin Luther King on what would have been his 68th birthday today. And then we're going to talk about the agreement reached over Hebron. That's all coming up. But right now, we're going to finish up our discussion on D.C. and what the Clinton administration proposed yesterday to the new plan to oversee the District of Columbia and end the federal payments to D.C. We're joined by Sam Jordan, chair of the D.C. Statehood Party, and Carol O'Clarican from the Brookings Institution, who has proposed her own plan. It's called the Orphaned Capital, Adopting a Revenue Plan for the District of Columbia. I wanted to get your response, Sam Jordan, to what Carol just said.
Right. I think it still agrees. It still avoids the basic question of the relationship between the federal government and the District of Columbia. We're talking about structural relationships that need to be mended. Neither of these plans amends a structural relationship. The structural relationship that needs to be mended is the fact that the District of Columbia generates a substantial pool of revenues, is due a substantial pool of revenues, but its access to that pool of revenues is blocked by its relationship with the federal government, which only requires a simple vote of the majority of both houses of Congress and the signature of the president. What we would end up doing is, one, correcting what has been a hostile relationship from Congress over 200 years, emphasize or characterize by at least two policies. One, total disenfranchisement of the local electorate, and two, prohibition of access to our natural revenue pool. And that would include, as I mentioned earlier, this reciprocal taxation of all incomes earned at its source. Ms. O'Clarican's plan does not address this. What her plan does is address the need for a larger federal payment. And this whole idea of state-type functions was not a discussion before Home Rule. It's now a discussion, state-type functions, because it actually provides a hook under which to remove those functions from provision by the District of Columbia. It doesn't mean that they necessarily have to be. If we have a relationship with the district, with the federal government based on, one, the federal government making a fair payment for its burden on the city. It's a $2 billion burden. We only get $660 million. That's less than a third. It doesn't account for the monies we lose to non-resident wage earners. In fact, that payment that the federal government does give to
people
the District of Columbia,
from Virginia, from Maryland,
who work here but don't pay taxes here, unlike any other jurisdiction in the nation, what that payment amounts to is actually a subsidy by the citizens of the rest of the nation to Maryland and Virginia.
Of about $1 billion.
Because they do not support and do not give us a fair reciprocal taxation payment that obtains anywhere else around the nation. Then we mustn't overlook the non-taxed large corporation sector. That includes Fannie Mae, Sally Mae, National Geographic. Right there, $500 million.
Carol O'Clarican, you made a face on that one.
Well, I just because that the exemption for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Sally Mae, is congressional. It's national legislation. They would take that income. They are exempt from state and local income taxes wherever they go. So if they would be taxed in one, no place can tax them. If they chose to locate in New York, it would be New York's loss. If they chose to locate in Florida, it would be Florida's loss. It turns out it's the district's loss.
What's missing from that formulation is a definitive solution. You see, we have a number of plans, and we've had plans for the last century, the Morrill Plan, the Nelson Plan, the Rivlin Commission. We've had the GAO. We have the Appleseed Foundation. We have a number of plans. The D.C. Statehood Party has offered a plan. The point is, until the issue of sovereignty is addressed, that is, with full jurisdictional responsibility for its budget, for its laws, for its judiciary, rests in the hands of D.C. citizens through the exercise of the vote, like anywhere else in the nation, and we pay for it.
Do you think D.C. could afford to be a state just by itself, one city, one state?
There's no doubt about it. In fact, if we were to resolve this question with the federal government about what is a fair evaluated payment for its burden on the city, there alone, one half of that is $1 billion. Remember, the plan that Mr. Clarricane offers is only $1.2 billion. Okay, that's $1 billion alone there. Okay, if we had even a 2% tax for the non-resident taxpayers, another $450 million. Now, if we had some payment in lieu of taxes from these large organizations, even a negotiated payment of one-third of what they might owe us, another $300 million. So there is $2 billion just on the basis of economic justice where there is a sovereignty issue and can't be changed at the whim of Congress.
I'm an economist, and it's hard for me to overlook the fact that this is a very small open economy, the District of Columbia. It's only 500,000 people. And it doubles in size on a work day, and Sam is absolutely correct. All these people come in from other places. But this is there's very easy access to this place. These borders are going to be crossed all the time. You don't eliminate the economic problem by labeling this a state as opposed to labeling it a city. You can solve some of the tax reach problems, which is what Sam is focused on, but you basically don't solve the economic problem, and you can't keep levying taxes on the district in to provide a level of both state and city services that isn't provided in the surrounding areas, because people don't have to carry that burden anymore.
This is a political question, but that I'm going to ask. But the whole issue of taxation without representation—how do you deal with that? Although
you are an economist, I think it's outrageous
that these people don't have real senators and Congress members who live in Washington, D.C.
And the research I did on this showed that this country is the only country in the world, right, listed in UN statistics, where the people in the capital city of that country do not have elected representation in their national legislature, and I think that's terrible.
So how do you do it, then, if you don't support a state?
But that was not my plan.
Yes.
All right, I was looking at the revenue side. I don't know. You know, everything that Sam's talking about is going to require amending the U.S. Constitution.
It does
not.
It's very important.
We're up for that.
No, it's very important that, in fact, I'm glad you made that mistake, because there is no constitutional amendment addressing statehood at all in the U.S. Constitution.
If statehood
required a constitutional amendment, we would at least have 37 constitutional amendments dealing with statehood after the original 13. Statehood for the District of Columbia only requires a simple majority of both houses and the signature of the president. It would, however, settle once and for all this question of sovereignty and provide a definitive solution. It is one of the most civically important, but issues of ignorance around the country, and I'm glad we got a chance to talk about this. Many people don't know that Washington, D.C. not only supports this burden of the federal government, but 55% of its land mass is tax-free. That 41% of the tax of the property that's tax-exempt actually accounts for 55% of the land mass in the city.
Sam Jordan, we do have to wrap, and this discussion of D.C. statehood is one that we want to have, and we're not going to be able to resolve right now. But I want to end with this question. What's going to happen now? The president has unveiled his plan. Carol O'Clarkin, you have unveiled your proposal.
I don't have the clout of the
revenue.
President.
That's true. So what is going to happen right now? Where does it go from here? The White House makes its proposal. It goes to Congress?
We'll see these battling proposals, and there will be hearings, and certainly the statehood party and those who support a definitive solution will certainly attempt to educate the public on this matter. However, let me assure you, neither or none of these plans will be effective as long as the issue of sovereignty is not resolved and as long as it's left to the whim of the very next Congress to approve of the
disapproval. And, you know, we haven't heard from the Republican Congress yet at all.
We have heard.
Well, they're angry.
Lars Faircloth says he will not support a giveaway, a big ripoff to the District of Columbia. He's already signaled
his
approach.
And that's a bad vocabulary, too. But we haven't heard something positive. We haven't seen a proposal.
Oh, yeah, they're attacking it.
We haven't seen a proposal
yet. So, ultimately, Congress is going to decide, a Congress that does not have the residents of D.C. represented.
In fact, Congress has been pursuing a policy over the last, since Home Rule, that actually indicates its begrudging acceptance of it, its enmity, its animosity toward it. In fact, since Home Rule, we've always had a dwindling federal payment. Based on what? Based on the fact that we have even a gesture of local government.
But
we
need total local autonomy.
But I think
we should end on a positive note, which is we're starting 1997 discussing the district, and we have alternative plans, and we have things that are changing the vocabulary and changing the level at which the discussion is going to take place. And
well, let's look at it
always
a
consider
note.
That good.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, but we are going to continue the discussion of the issue of D.C. statehood, and that goes beyond the issue of taxation. We want to thank Sam Jordan, chair of the D.C. Statehood Party, who's a research fellow over at the Institute for Policy Studies here, and Carol O'Clerican, visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. Her plan for D.C. is called the Orphan Capital, Adopting a Revenue Plan for the District of Columbia. You're listening to Democracy Now! Wonder singing Happy Birthday, Martin. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we're joined in these few minutes by Lawrence Guillet. He's a local activist here, actually a statehood activist in D.C. He's an advisory neighborhood commissioner, that's an ANC, in the Howard University area. But most importantly for this discussion, he was chair of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in the 1960s, and he worked throughout the 60s with Martin Luther King. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's indeed a pleasure to be here. You know, the irony, American people do not understand that in their name, there's total disenfranchisement of everyone in the District of Columbia, with the exception of five people. And those are the five members of the control board. I think that the reason that the president acted, and those of you who were lucky enough to see Mr. Raines on C-SPAN, were openly lied to. Mr. Raines told you that democracy runs rampant in the District of Columbia. That's a lie. The 15th Amendment says that the Congress nor any state shall deny or abridge the right to vote. I left Mississippi fighting for the right to vote. I participated in the Freedom Summer Project to bring the country and the nation to do away with the disenfranchisement of Mississippi. I worked with Martin Luther King in both the freedom election and our attempt to unseat the regular Democratic Party in Mississippi, in which we were successful because we created a rule saying that now all delegations from any state have to be 50% female, that a segregated delegation to the Democratic Convention will never be seated. We helped pass the Voting Rights Act, and now we sit, everyone who attends the inauguration will be attending a celebration of the disenfranchisement of everyone in the District of Columbia. I worked hard to elect Clinton, but in good conscience, I cannot attend anything related to his inauguration. Because I think that anyone that does, anyone who comes from any political subdivision in America, should ask themselves two questions. Do I defend the disenfranchisement done in my name of the fellow Americans who live in the District of Columbia?
Did Martin Luther King ever have anything to say about the District of Columbia?
Martin Luther King said this. He said, as long as people in the state of Mississippi do not have the vote, and as long as people in New York do not have anyone to vote for, America is not America. All he has to do, all we have to do is change the words Mississippi to the District of Columbia. We do not have access to the ballot. Now, I think the reason the White House acted so quickly is not the inauguration, but there's a very successful lawsuit that has been filed, Shook versus the Control Board. That's why they're moving, because the fundamental questions
the
there...
The Control Board is what the Congress has imposed on Washington, D.C.
Right.
to take over.
The junta of America, with the blessing of every American, because it's done in the name of the Congress that belongs to us. So I don't want anyone in America to feel unresponsible about this. Where would Martin Luther King stand on this? He's just as predictable on this as would be Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass said, give us the vote, and we will settle the political affairs of America. Martin Luther King, in 1957, compared the vote to all political power because of the pervasiveness of politics in America. It is antithetical to patriotism for America to silently sit by like good Germans and watch the disenfranchisement of the District of Columbia.
Let me get away a little bit from the District of Columbia and move more generally to Martin Luther King and your memories of him in the 1960s and what you think many people, young people in particular, don't understand about King from the way he is popularized.
King was 17 years old before he decided to become a minister. King was a man who was not an icon as far as he was concerned. He loved Southern cooking. He loved to read. He loved people. With him, everyone counted. He was a tremendously brave man. He knew that the FBI was hounding him. He knew that there was an attempt to control him and decide what he does. But look at what he did. He went to Riverside Church, and he spoke out against Vietnam. And as they were leaving, Mitchell, the head of the NAACP, Roy Wilkins, said to him, "Well, Roy, I understand you Martin, I understand you were walking with some people yesterday." And he said, "Yes, I was. Why weren't you there?" So I think what Martin Luther King brought to realization was the role of the church as a liberation organization, the role of the South as a place to challenge the country on the 15th and making the 15th Amendment a reality. He openly challenged the Vietnam War. He openly dealt with sexism. I think that, and the beautiful thing about Martin was very human. He loved women. And we make the distinction now. We look at Clinton and we say, well, Clinton is a libertine. Well, Martin Luther King was a libertine, but the country was sophisticated enough to understand the difference between his personal life and his public life. His contribution will live as long as dissent lives, as long as democracy lives, as long as people yearn to be free. There will be a place for Martin Luther King to be.
Right now, there's a controversy over his image and his work. It all has to do with its commercial copyright, intellectual copyright. His family is fighting with a number of corporations and also news organizations who sell his words as part of packages, like a suit that was against CBS News. Do you have any comment on this?
Well, you know, it's such an idiocy. No one can capture or commercialize the ferment and the vitality and the rhapsody of freedom that is and was Martin Luther King. I hope that there will be some settlement of this so that there can be as much exposure of his ideas as possible, because we live now in a more racially polarized America than when Martin Luther King was with us. The Kerner Commission validates that. The Kettering Institute validates that. And the Eisenhower Commission validates that. So if we live in two Americas, one black, one white. And so we need not look at Martin Luther King as a historical figure, but at his contemporary relevance.
How did you first meet Dr. Martin Luther King?
I first met him in the chapel of Tougaloo College in 1957. He had just been involved in the boycott, and he was brought to Mississippi by Aaron Henry, who was then the chairman of the NAACP in the state. He spoke to us in the chapel at Tougaloo, and it was electrifying. Here was the embodiment of a man who was fearless, who was religious, who was patriotic, and who was very, very political.
You were in SNCC at the time?
No, this was before I joined SNCC.
Before, it's 57.
This was 57. I didn't join SNCC until 61. And it was an experience I never forgot. And I met him again and on different occasions in Jackson, Mississippi, Hattiesburg, and other places. But his ability to bring people together and to justify liberation and action that led to liberation was unparalleled.
Well, Lawrence Guillet, I want to thank you very much for joining us for these few minutes. Of course, the national holiday, the federal holiday that is Martin Luther King's birthday, will be celebrated on Monday, which this year is Inauguration Day.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, Lawrence Guillot, former SNCC member, now an ANC, an advisory neighborhood commissioner in the Howard University area of Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us.
Okay.
And when we come back, we're going to discuss the Hebron Accord that was reached last night. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last night, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat finally agreed to a partial Israeli pullout of the West Bank town of Hebron. The deal marks at least some movement in the long-stalled peace process, which has remained more or less blocked since right-wing Likud party leader Netanyahu assumed power 7 months ago. But despite the accord, the mood in Israel is decidedly gloomy last night, and most analysts say that prospects for further movement in the peace process may remain elusive. Joining us right now to talk about the situation from Jerusalem is independent journalist Peretz Kedron, who is involved with the peace movement in Israel. We're also joined from our New York studios by Norman Finkelstein. He is author of a new book called Rise and Fall of Palestine. It's put out by University of Minnesota Press. Was that true, Peretz Kedron, that the mood in Israel is a bit glum? Peretz, are you there?
We were decidedly cheerful and felt relieved. I must say that I celebrated the event by driving past the place where the very first demonstration against the Hebron settlement set out in 1969. And it's been a long campaign and a long struggle, which isn't over yet, but this is definitely a major step forward.
I guess I was reading from the New York Times, and I have to remember not to trust it.
Well, trusted in part because some people are definitely gloomy. Certainly the extreme right wing, the settlers, are speaking in absolutely apocalyptic terms. And that's a sizable chunk of public opinion that supports them. But I would say the overwhelming majority of Israelis feel a sense of relief.
Parents,
there is some progress.
What do you think is good about it?
Movement. The only thing that can stop the peace process is if it grinds to a halt. It can't be rolled back. The dynamism, the fact that this is withdrawal from part of the sacred land of Israel, and that withdrawal is being authorized and carried out by a government headed by the right-wing Likud, with members including factions like the National Religious Party, which is effectively the party of the settlers, and other right-wing parties. They're the ones who are carrying it out. What we're witnessing, though it's very small in actual physical terms, is the collapse of the whole concept of Greater Israel, of the land of Israel as being entirely a monopoly of the Jewish people. That doesn't necessarily mean that the deal that's being worked out is wonderful or ideal for the Palestinians, but at least it gives them some breathing space and a fighting chance to establish themselves.
Norman Finkelstein, from your seat here in the United States, what are your thoughts on the Hebron Accord that was reached just last night?
Well, I do agree that a process is unfolding. The question is, what process that is? As far as I could tell, what's happening now is the consolidation of the Labor Party's longstanding, the consolidation of the Labor Party's longstanding plans to, in effect, divide the West Bank between Israel and the Palestinians, the Israelis taking the resources and whatever land they want, and leaving the Palestinians to basically stew in their own juices in Bantustans. That seems to me the logic of the process, and I do have to respectfully disagree with Peretz Kedron. Movement does not always mean progress. Movement, it depends on movement in which direction. One must remember in the case of the establishment of the Bantustans in South Africa, there was movement. There was also serious resistance by South African whites, including within the apartheid government cabinet, opposed to the consolidation of a Bantustan regime. There was also serious resistance in South Africa by the white settlers in the Bantustan areas. The fact that there is resistance in the case of South Africa by whites, or in the case of Israel by nationalists and religious fanatics, the fact that there is resistance to the process does not necessarily prove that the process is moving in the direction of peace. And in my view, at any rate, the process that's unfolding now pretty much resembles what happened in South Africa. There will be a division of the West Bank. The Palestinians will be granted a state, exactly as Transkei, Ciskei, Bofuth Atswana were also granted full statehood. But that doesn't mean the Palestinians are getting anything out of it, unless you believe the Bantustans were a victory for liberation in South Africa.
Would you think it would be better for the Israelis not to pull out of Hebron?
I'll tell you the truth. I have mixed feelings on that particular issue. The Israelis, as you know, are not moving out of Hebron. They're simply consolidating, as Patrick Coburn correctly put it in the British Independent, they're simply consolidating the partition of Hebron. 400 Jewish settlers were given approximately 20% of Hebron. A wall is now going to be built, incidentally, at American taxpayer expense, down the main street of Hebron, dividing the Jewish from the Palestinian side. Whether that's a victory for Palestinians, it seems to me, it's dubious, though I have to concede that for all the brutalities of the Arafat's surrogate government, they won't be expelling Palestinians from their homes, which is in effect what the settlers were doing. And to that extent, yes, it is a small victory, I suppose, for Palestinians. But to believe that this is a process which is going to terminate injustice for the Palestinians, it seems to me is extremely naive. If I just may quote Ehud Barak, who's this, one of the senior members of the Labor Party, when he was recently interviewed on the question of the occupied territories, he stated forthrightly, he said that Yitzhak Rabin, when he signed the Oslo Accord, had what he called the Alone Plan in mind. The Alone Plan, for your listeners, was the original Labor Party conception of how to finish off the conquest of the West Bank, taking into account that the Palestinians were there to stay. You couldn't, as in 1948, expel them. And the only alternative in the history of conquest, if you can't exterminate an indigenous population and you can't expel an indigenous population, the only alternative that remains is to encircle that indigenous population. That was the Alone Plan in 1969, 1968. The Alone Plan was validated or ratified in the Oslo Accord. And now Mr. Netanyahu, who's a pretty, you know, fairly typical, rational conqueror, recognizes and is trying to get his constituency to recognize that that's the only alternative open to Israel now. They don't want the people, they want the land. The people, alas, are there to stay, so then confine them in Bantustans, take the land that you can, take the water that you can, and put in place a Quisling regime to do Israel's bidding, willingly or unwillingly is irrelevant, to do Israel's bidding within the Bantustans.
Peretz Gudron, what are your thoughts on Norman's analysis?
I could outdo the speaker with on bewailing the ideal solution, which would restore the Palestinians all their rights. What you have to understand in the political realities, not in some cloud cuckoo land, in the political realities, as long as the Palestinians were pursuing their ideal and full rights, they got nowhere. They're now come to the bitter understanding that there are small and weak people living alongside a much stronger, much more powerful entity, and as such, they have to grab what they can get. Crying for the moon, they'll get nothing at all, and that's the history of the dispute rather than the details that were listed here. And true friends of the Palestinians, not those who advise them to hold out for the till the last Palestinian, but to advise them to move ahead, would point to minor details like the fact that at the moment 150,000 Palestinians live under Israeli rule, and under this terrible, terrible solution, which is going to commit so many injustices to the Palestinians, 130,000 will move to Palestinian rule. Now, this may be trivial to a person who's never lived under military government and doesn't know what that exactly means, but I think that a week or so, if he were subjected to that kind of existence, I think he'd be convinced that this is rather more than a trivial improvement or marginal improvement. The fact of the matter is that this has to be regarded in broader terms. True, all the points were raised, the Alon plan, the plans for expansion, these are facts of life. Israel is a powerful entity, and a powerful entity living alongside a weaker entity uses elbow. I don't think you need to go very far from where you're sitting. Just ask the Mexicans how they feel sitting alongside the United States, or maybe in this part of the world, how the Poles feel sitting between Germany and Russia. These are geopolitical facts which have to be dealt with, and sitting in some academic ivory tower and sketching out an ideal is no political solution. This is the Palestinian tragedy, and the Palestinians are moving away from that tragedy and trying to settle for what they can get. I agree with you, it's very, very far from ideal. Now, whether this is going to be a Bantustan or not, that's definitely an option, that's definitely a possibility. considering the resistance and the fighting power and the ingenuity that the Palestinians have exhibited in the past decade, particularly, I don't think it'll be a Bantustan. It will be a small state, a weak state, that will have to tread very carefully and warily in its relationship with a very powerful neighbor. But I don't think that they're not going to be quislings. I think that these loaded terms are utterly misleading, and it can only encourage people to set up a false illusion and a false ideal which can't be attained, and therefore to waive those achievements which are attainable in practical political terms.
Well, Norman Finkelstein, that idea that to be totally rejectionist right now ignores the reality that Palestinians have been under Israeli military rule and now are moving to Palestinian rule.
Well, if I may enter a small stipulation from Cuckoo Land and the Ivory Tower, perhaps Peretz Kedron does not know that I did live in the West Bank in the village of Beit Sahur and the Palestinian refugee camp of Fawar in the summers of 1988, 89, 90, 91, 92, and 93. So when I speak, I don't think I'm speaking from any lofty ivory tower, or for that matter, from a Tel Aviv cafe. I do think I'm speaking with a certain amount of personal, if not authority, at any rate a certain personal knowledge of the military occupation. And I would be the very last one to want to minimize the significance of that occupation. Nonetheless, it does seem to me that one's responsibility is not to create illusions about a peace process, or at least not create illusions about where this particular so-called peace process is going to terminate. Mr. Kedron states that 150,000 Palestinians have moved from Israeli rule to Palestinian rule. Well, I wish that were the case. What in fact happened is 150,000 Palestinians have moved from direct Israeli rule to the rule of Israel through its quisling or surrogate government, namely the Palestinian Authority. I suspect that Mr. Arafat would himself acknowledge that the Palestinians have no say in what's going on in their authority. Yes, they can decide when the garbage will be collected and when the schools will open and close, which in fact they were able to do in 1987, before the Intifada. The civil administration was under the control of Palestinians. Yes, there is now a Palestinian authority, there's a Palestinian police, but that police's responsibility is fairly plain to anyone. For example, if I just may quote to you from the New York Times this morning, Serge Schmiman was writing a roundup piece on the Israel-Palestine Accord yesterday, and he refers to the events in Jerusalem a couple of months back that spurred the violence. And this is what he writes. He writes, "The violence," referring to the Jerusalem events, "the violence represented everybody's worst fears. Palestinian policemen allowed to carry arms by Israel to control their population turned them on Israeli soldiers." Yes, that's everyone's worst fears, everyone who counts worst fears. The purpose of the Palestinian police force is to control the Palestinians. Its purpose is to take aim at the Palestinians. The purpose of the Israeli army is also to control the Palestinians. That's Mr. Arafat's purpose, and in fact, Mr. Rabin was very honest about it at the time of the Oslo I Accord in September 1993. He said, "Now that we have this accord, we won't have all these peace types, this B'Tselem, the Israeli Center for Human Rights, filing protests about torture, killing, and so forth, because now all the work will be done by Mr. Arafat," which in fact he is doing for the Israelis effectively, "and our hands will be free. Our image will once again be beautiful, and we will get everything we want.
On that
note, we'll get the land, we'll get the water, and the Palestinians get a police force which they can aim at themselves."
Peretz Kedron, we just have actually a few more seconds. I give you the last word.
Mr. Arafat, who dedicated his entire life to the Palestinian national struggle, you reduce him to the role of a petty quisling. I think it shows the degree of your understanding of the realities. Maybe you really should spend a few more summers at Beit Sakhor. You get much more of a picture.
Well, I'm going to leave it at that. Norman Finkelstein, his new book is called The Rise and Fall of Palestine. It's put out by University of Minnesota Press. We've also been joined by Peretz Kedron, an independent journalist who is involved in the peace movement in Jerusalem. You're listening to Democracy Now!, which is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Kenneth Mason is our engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive director. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, Bernadette Makalitsky, and we'll look at a new movie, Some Other Son. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Anyone who takes offense.